Hi everybody, welcome to Read Science. This is Joanne Manister, Science Goddess on Twitter, here with my co-host Jeff, as always, where we talk with guests or guests about some writing or other communication they have done about science. And today I'm very pleased to welcome Paul, Knopfler, which do you prefer?
Knopfler.
Knopfler. And today his book is GMO Sapiens, The Life-Changing Science of Designer Babies, but you've also written a book about stem cells. And actually the timing of today's show was supposed to follow an FDA hearing about stem cells, but they moved it. But that's okay, because we are still really excited to talk about all this cutting-edge biology that Paul knows a lot about and is adept at communicating to the general public. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk with you guys.
And I'm going to go ahead and find your official bio that I had here. I promise I did. I restarted. So what happened was it disappeared. There it is. Okay, so the official bio now. Dr. Paul Knopfler is an associate professor in cell biology and human anatomy at the UC Davis School of Medicine and a faculty member of the UC Davis Genome Center Cancer Center, where he is the leader of the Cancer Stem Cell Initiative and the Institute for Regenerative Cures. These are all things I love to study myself. So, Dr. Knopfler is also an associate investigator of the Institute for Pediatric Regenerative Medicine at Shriners Hospital of Northern California. He teaches a graduate developmental biology course and histology at UC Davis School of Medicine. Dr. Knopfler is also a cancer survivor and a patient advocate. In addition, he writes the stem cell blog, ipscell.com, a vehicle for educational outreach efforts and patient advocacy. He has written two books, Stem Cells, An Insider's Guide, and today's book, GMO Sapiens, The Life-Changing Science of Designer Babies. Very exciting. All right, so everybody, welcome to the program. If you have a question, feel free to drop one in, and also, I think I will turn things over to Jeff, where he will ask the first question.
Right. So we're going, this is my chance today to learn about all sorts of things, like cutting edge stuff like stem cells and genetic modification research. And I think I want to start with something basic, because when we talk about the book, we're going to be talking about designer babies, genetically modified humans, and we're going to be talking a lot about the science and about the ethics of all of that. And I think the big question is, why are we talking about this now? And I think that, you know, one gets directly to the answer, it's CRISPR. And so I would like, because I've not gotten a very clear understanding yet, I'd like the brief history of what this CRISPR thing is, where it came from, and then I would like to hear what it is that CRISPR does and how it works. And I would like to do with as few metaphors as we can. I'd like to hear, you know, words like proteins and enzymes, because I'm starting to understand those, and I want to get that picture that's a little more specific. So how did we get here? What is CRISPR?
Well, I love metaphors, but I'll try to avoid using them. So let me just give a little bit of history, because I've been working on genetic modification for a long time, and I want to sort of give the context of how we used to do this, because how we used to do it was very expensive and funky. And what we used to do is rely upon a process called homologous recombination, where we would, say, generate a stretch of DNA in the lab that is similar to a gene, for example, but has a key difference. So it might have a part of the gene missing, or it might have something that essentially kind of shuts down the function of that gene. And so we would make that DNA in the lab, we'd introduce it into embryonic stem cells, for example, and then very rarely that would get swapped into the genome of the cells in place of the naturally occurring gene. And maybe it would, again, it might knock that gene out, that's the terminology we use.
This is where we talk about knockout mice and things like
exactly,
that.
Exactly, yeah, so this right. is how we make knockout mice. You could use the same approach in cells, but it would probably take, you know, a year or two, tens of thousands of dollars, and very low efficiency process. Sometimes didn't work at all. And so that's really how we've done things for decades. So CRISPR is very different, and it's much faster and it's much cheaper. And CRISPR has an interesting origin. It really comes more from the microbiology kind of field. And so CRISPR refers actually to sort of a naturally occurring sort of innate immune system that bacteria have. Mm-hmm. And they use this to fight off viral infections. So just like people, bacteria can get infected by viruses too, and that's a bad thing for them. You know, it can kill them and kill entire populations of bacteria. So they've evolved CRISPR in part as a way to fight those viruses off. And what they do is they have a combination of RNAs and nucleases, which are proteins that chew up DNA or RNA. And through this combination system, basically, when they sense that they have been infected by a bacteriophage, for example, they can fight back. And what they do is they target the nucleotides of the genome of the virus, and they bring in another protein called Cas9 or other similar proteins that essentially chew up DNA. And so in this way, bacteria have been able to fight back against viruses. And part of the especially neat part of this is that the bacteria essentially have a memory over time, it seems. They can chop up the virus's DNA and then tuck away little components of that viral DNA as like a memory. And then if they're infected in the future or their sort of offspring bacteria are infected down the road, they can mount a quicker response. They kind of recognize this DNA as, you know, an attacker, and then they fight it off. And so,
do they recognize this thing through nucleotide sequence matching?
They do. Yes. Yeah, that's how it works. And so they produce RNAs that are kind of floating around, and if those essentially hit a match, like in a viral sequence, then they can recruit in the mm-hmm. chewing machinery of Cas9 or other Cases.
Okay.
And then the virus is history. And so a number of different researchers contributed to the understanding of CRISPR-Cas9 over a long period of time. And for most of its history, it really wasn't thought of as something particularly relevant, say, to eukaryotes and people and medicine. But at some point, different researchers with different interests came up with the idea that it could be used as a tool and adapted to improve upon what I mentioned earlier as our clunky, expensive way of doing gene editing. And so these different researchers, Jennifer Doudna and others, came up with the idea that, hey, maybe we could change, you know, adapt, turn this into a tool. And so now what we've got just in the last 3 years is a whole bunch of different adaptations of CRISPR-Cas9 that can be used in mouse cells, human cells, and they can be used to do very precise things. They can be used to they could be used to knock out genes, but they could also be used to make very fine changes in the DNA sequence. And the way that we do this, we're doing some of this in my lab to study stem cells and cancer. It kind of unfolds over a period of weeks and months rather than years. So mm-hmm. for us scientists, that's a really great thing. It makes us very happy. And it's a pretty straightforward thing. So it's not something that's going to cost a lab tens of thousands of dollars. You know, it might cost just a few thousand dollars. And it's just very efficient. And so we can take advantage of CRISPR-Cas9 and we can direct it, say, to our favorite gene of interest that might be involved in cancer. And we can use something called guide RNAs, which are sort of the GPS, sorry for the metaphor, to direct through nucleotide homology to a specific gene. And then Cas9 can go in there, and that's the enzymatic part, and cut that gene. And so it gets pretty interesting because then the cell actually kind of contributes to its own genetic modification, because once we have a cut there, then the cell tries to repair that. And mm-hmm. it's through that repair process that either we can knock the gene out because the cell will make a mistake sometimes mm-hmm. and change the coding sequence of the gene in such a way that it doesn't function anymore. Or because of that cut, and again, the cell is trying to repair it, It can try to repair it through something called homology-directed repair. Mm-hmm. And we can kind of trick the cell because we can put in, it would normally use a sister chromosome, you know, which has the intact sequence as the template to fix this. But we can flood the cell with an artificial homology template.
Okay.
And so some of the time, it will use that instead to try to fix that cut. And so, for instance, we could put in a homology template, we call it, that has a sequence that changes a codon from making a methionine, say, to an alanine or something else like that. And so we can essentially take advantage of this bacterial system, take advantage of mammalian cell repair mechanisms, and together make these genetic modifications. And there's some asterisks on there, like the efficiency varies, you know, depending on the gene, on the lab, on, again, there's literally dozens of different adaptations of CRISPR-Cas9, so a lot depends on how you go about doing this, but it's overall, it's much quicker and more efficient than what we used to do.
But because you're trying to leverage this repair mechanism and use that, blooding the materials in or something, hoping that they'll get used, it's not as deterministic as saying, well, you cut this out and you put this one in, but rather you do this and then you do something that has a good probability of obtaining, of getting to where you want to be, but not guaranteed to get you where you want.
Right, right. That's definitely true. And an important aspect of this is and that and this doesn't get talked about enough, is once you do this, you then have to do a bunch of validation studies.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to screen through different cells, and you have to sequence their DNA, and you have to look to see, you know, did we get what we wanted? Did we get something different? The other big issue that especially comes into play when we talk about using this in human beings is that CRISPR-Cas9 is not perfect. So it's better than what we used to do, but it still can make mistakes. And so it can, there's a variety of things that can kind of go wrong, and these can happen at your gene of interest, that, you know, your bullseye, or it can happen that CRISPR-Cas9 goes to an entirely different gene and edits that, you know, genetically modifies that, and that obviously could be a bad thing.
So the validation step is where you would do this, say, on an egg cell, and then let it develop till you have a blastocyst with, what, 8 cells or something, and then you can take one out and look to see whether it did what you wanted?
Yeah, so it gets kind of tricky when you think about the human reproductive kind of context, but one of the sort of guiding principles is that CRISPR-Cas9 so far really seems to work in any kind of cell. So what I tell people is that a fertilized human egg is a cell. Yeah. And so as much as it's a pretty amazing cell that can under the right circumstances, create a human being, it's still a cell, and so it still, you know, is susceptible to CRISPR. It still needs to repair its DNA. So by all indications, CRISPR-Cas9 is going to work in human fertilized eggs. And so the validation there is much trickier than, you know, just in embryonic stem cells and culture. So, for example, we can introduce CRISPR-Cas9 into 1 million embryonic stem cells, and we can have, you know, a ton of different cells to then screen, validate, look through. But in a typical experiment with a fertilized human egg, you might have one, you might have half a dozen of those,
right?
And you don't have this whole range to screen necessarily. And the other thing is the screening's tricky because, like you indicated, you have to wait for that cell to divide into 2, into 4, into 8. And somewhere after the 8 cell stage up to the blastocyst stage, which in humans has about 100 cells, the idea is you do this thing called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD, where you pluck a cell off. You might pluck 3 or 6 cells off, and you use those to kind of get a sense, to kind of sample what is going on with your genetic modification. And so you kind of get a window into what's going on. Have you made the, you know, has CRISPR done the right thing? Has it not done the wrong thing? And so those cells, the genomic analysis you do there, on those cells that you've isolated, is really your only opportunity to get a sense of what is going on. And there's some challenges to that, too, because say you have a 100-cell embryo and you do PGD analysis on 6 cells, the other 94 cells are not guaranteed to be the same.
Right.
And so we've seen last year a group out of China, and then actually just a few days ago, another group out of China have actually used CRISPR in human embryos to try to make specific genetic modifications. And they found a number of problems and challenges, and one of them actually is something called chimerism, which you guys might be familiar with. Yeah. And this is the idea that whether it's in an embryo or in a person or in an animal, not all the cells have the same genome, surprisingly. You know, even in all of us, you know, there is a little bit of what we call microchimerism. Mm-hmm. And so chimerism is a real concern when we talk about making designer babies because, again, by PGD, by sequencing the genome of those 1 to 6 cells, we can get a certain indication of what's going on. But because of this diversity due to chimerism, not all the cells in the embryo may be equal. If we then go on and implant that into a surrogate mother, for example, we make a human being, that human being probably has a pretty high chance of being a chimera in the sense that some of its tissues, some of its organs may have different outcomes, different genomes. You know, some may have had the gene edit, some may have not had the genetic modification, and so there's a lot of interesting challenges when you think about it from the reproductive perspective.
Thank you. That was the level of explanation I wanted for CRISPR, and I can understand it in a more physicist way now.
Okay, good.
Yeah, that's good. And so that then is our answer. We've thought about making designer babies for well over a century or longer. There's fiction and things. We'll get to the culture later. But this sense of urgency now that comes through in your book and in some meetings that have been going on is because now we have this enabling technology that's really enabling.
It is. It's very enabling. And like I said, we're using it in my lab for in vitro studies of cells. And that's really going on all around the world. There's a repository called AdGene that actually will give at cost. It doesn't really, I don't think, make any profit. It'll give anyone any of these CRISPR plasmids, other kinds of plasmids. Plasmids are little pieces of round DNA that are tools, basically. And so you can get from AdGene or other places all you need to do CRISPR-Cas9. And AdGene keeps statistics on these things. And they've sent out, I think, the CRISPR-Cas9 materials to more than 10,000 labs around the world, I think. So
yeah, you said some enormous number.
Yeah, it's very ubiquitous. So, so it's an interesting situation because you have this powerful, cheap, ubiquitous technology out there, and it's sort of, you know, we're feeling our way, we're kind of going empirically about the science side, the ethics side, and so it's sort of a very exciting, kind of scary time, I think.
Yeah, it definitely is. I had someone on Twitter say, oh, designer babies, it makes me worry about Gattaca,
yes.
You know, that kind of scenario. And you talk about that in the book. You talk about Gattaca. You talk about Orphan Black. I love Orphan Black.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we've been talking about for 10, 20 years, and it really feels to me like this kind of thing, the technology for these things, whether it's human cloning or genetically modifying our own self as a species, it's really something that is technologically feasible to try.
Mm-hmm.
Today, whereas maybe even just 6 years ago, it would have been much, you know, more impractical from a technical perspective. But it's something that people have been thinking, they've been scared, they've been excited, it's been very engaging for a long time. But today, the difference, I think the key difference is we have the technology to try it.
And it's almost possible now.
Right.
One thing that is going to keep coming up in that I want to try to figure out, because I don't know the answer, and you're the one, is... I understand the types, many of the anxieties and things about this sort of research. And I want to know, I'm trying to figure out where, if there's a single source, maybe not, but where those anxieties really come from versus where people say they're worried about, what they appear to be really worried about, and what are they really worried about. And when I was reading near the beginning, I think in the preface to the book, I made a comment, not a quotation, that says it struck me that genetic modification techniques and things is one of those technologically sweet but potentially horrifying things. And I'm a physicist, so I'm saying, is this a post-atomic bomb thing? Because it seems like the 20th century is nothing but object lessons about not doing things that are technologically sweet but have potentially horrifying consequences. How much of this is a sort of duck and cover feeling of, you know, we've spent so many decades trying to stuff genies back into bottles. You know, how much of it is, are we worried what's going to get out? Is this an atomic bomb? Vague, generalized sort of thing? I don't know, and it may be better to answer that sort of question later or as we go. But,
well, I can try to tackle it now, because when I was researching the book, which I started a couple years ago, one of my goals as I went through this was to talk to as many different people and get as many different perspectives as I could. I kind of went into it with my own, I don't know if we want to say bias or perspective, I'm somewhat of a cautionary person as much mm-hmm. as I love technology. And so in talking with this wide range of people, the types of reactions people had really ranged dramatically. Some people mm-hmm. thought of this as just a sweet technology, let's run with it, you know, let's just go for it. And an example of that might be the scientist Steven Pinker,
yeah.
who just loves technology, and I think he's potentially been provocative about, you know, let's push the bioethics side and let's just run with it. To other people who are much more concerned, and even some people who are very, you know, this evokes kind of a visceral, kind of fearful reaction. And I guess I find myself sort of in the middle somewhere. You know, I think this is very exciting, but I do have some concerns about how this could go wrong, you know, and there's a number mm-hmm. of things that I think there's some actual reasonable basis for being fearful. It's not just, you know, paranoia or some, you know, emotional response. And
your discussion seemed to me mostly to center around concern about unknown consequences.
Yeah, I think for me that's one of the big issues is when we go into the genome, and I've been studying the genome and all this stuff for a really long time, a lot of times when we do an experiment, the outcome is not what we expected, right? Our mm-hmm. hypothesis might be disproved, or it might be partially disproved. And so I think, you know, when we start talking about human beings as a product of an experiment, you know, if the outcome is not what we intended, it's not something where you can just sort of stop the experiment and say, oh, yeah. oops, you know.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about making, you know, people. And so that gets that's something that's really concerning to me. And if you look at some of the experiments that have been done just in the last couple of years with CRISPR and animals, you know, there's some really dramatic outcomes and not always, you know, entirely positive. We've seen, as I mentioned in the book, you know, animals that have been made that are what people call double-muscled pigs or super-muscled mm-hmm. pigs mm-hmm. by changing just one gene, this myostatin gene. But there's other things related to that. Like, we don't really know, do those animals have a shorter life? You know, how do they feel? We do know the mothers have difficulty giving birth to those mm-hmm. pigs because they're so big. And there may be other things that happen that we can't really anticipate. And so I'm concerned we could make children, for example, who have birth defects. That's really one of the top concerns I have mm-hmm. From a, you know, more direct individual outcome perspective. But I'm also worried it could kind of start changing how we view ourselves as people, and there's societal and social justice concerns. You know, maybe this becomes sort of a fashionable thing, like, you know, the new Kardashians maybe will be people who have genetic modifications, right? And this, yeah. this stuff sounds funny, but in doing research, I found already some fertility clinics do some pretty interesting things out there. Like, they'll allow customers to select gametes, most often sperm, that come from a donor that looks like their favorite celebrity, so that their child mm-hmm. might look like the celebrity to some extent. I have no mm-hmm. idea how all that works, but it just shows there's sort of a market for a lot of surprisingly, you know, I guess I would say, you know, controversial things in terms of reproduction.
Yeah. So I promise to let Joanne talk in just a minute, but you might want to do a quick dispelling of the myth. And whenever we have someone who does sell things here, I like to do this, like, especially with Evo Devo and things, we understand, but we still have not gotten rid of the popular notion that every characteristic on a human that you can name has a single gene associated with it, right. And that's pretty much all it does. And that's, like, so super wrong that the idea that just, like, oh, can't we have, you know, the gene for a big penis or something
right.
is just yeah. not going to work that way, because it's a developmental thing. And how you know, how many more decades is it going to take to get that notion?
Yeah, there's that myth, we call it, like, the mono genetic or monogene myth, where, like you were saying, there's sort of this one-to-one correspondence between gene A and, you know, trait A, and really that's only rarely true. The example with muscle is actually a good, relatively rare example where you can actually change that one gene, myostatin, and pretty reproducibly get more muscle.
And just that, pretty much?
Yeah, and usually that's not the case. So, for example, even with something that seems simple like eye color or hair color or skin pigmentation, it's pretty complicated, and it's much more complicated than we used to think. There's a lot of genes involved. And then if you take it a step further to something like intelligence, there's probably hundreds of genes involved. And so it's an interesting, there was a challenge for me in writing about it, the idea, for example, of trying to boost intelligence, because on the one hand, you probably could not do that, you know, easily or ever with genetic modification, because intelligence is so complicated. But on the other hand, on the flip side, people are talking about that. And so I think it's something that needs to be addressed. But certainly in general, you know, there's not a one gene, one trait kind of link. And what got me even more concerned about that as I was writing the book is that there are some scientists who I think are kind of falling into that trap, you know, in terms of they're promoting this idea of using CRISPR on people for perhaps getting better, in quotation mark, traits. And sometimes I feel like they've fallen into that monogenic trap because things are very complicated. The other thing, the other myth that's out there, or maybe it's not really a myth, but just something that often gets neglected, is that even if CRISPR works 100% perfectly and we change up our gene in the precise way we want to, it may not do what we only one thing. It may do multiple things. There may be multiple consequences. So we may, for example, tweak myostatin and get, you know, a person with big muscles, but that same person may have a change, for all we know, they may have a change, you know, cognition or something like that, or their heart muscle might be, you know, changed in a way that is not desirable. And so not only are there multiple genes feeding into single traits, but there are single genes feeding into multiple, you know, outcomes, multiple traits. And so that's where I think, you know, if we start changing up people's genomes, you know, we have to be prepared for unexpected outcomes.
Right, and we have a lot of examples of where you have a gene that seems, you know, deleterious, but in its heterozygous state can actually be beneficial depending on where you live. So sickle cell anemia for malaria. And so,
Great example.
You know, but maybe, you know, let's say we made giant muscles, but then it makes us more susceptible to some other infectious disease or...
Right, or heart disease. That's a great point. And one other really great example is this gene called CCR5, which there's a certain variant that makes people resistant to HIV. And so there's been a lot of talk about targeting CCR5 to create this naturally occurring rare variant that is somewhat helpful in preventing HIV infection. But the same gene variant actually makes those people more susceptible to West Nile virus. And so...
Right. No, and as we see with Zika, any infectious disease can take off at any time.
Right, that's true. And so I think, you know, there's always going to be, I think, not always, but there's always a risk that you're going to make one change that might be thought of as beneficial and you're going to get a second change or more that maybe you're not so happy about, you know. And the CCR5 thing is really interesting because the paper... on the genetic modification of human embryos, the second one that just came out a few days ago, that was actually their target. They wanted to make a modified form of CCR5 in these human embryos in a dish, and in fact, they had a lot of trouble doing that. And it was interesting to see what issues they ran into there, and one of them was chimerism, which is something that we alluded to, but the other thing was that the DNA repair mechanism kind of didn't go quite the way they expected, and so they wanted to mutate the CCR5 gene to make this naturally occurring variant in a very precise way. But I think most of the time what happened instead is the cells used a different DNA repair mechanism called non-homologous end joining, where when you get a cut in DNA, instead of trying to use homology to fix that, it just basically glues the ends back together. And oftentimes what happens is you get little pieces of DNA that are inserted there, or little pieces get deleted, and those are called indels for insertions and deletions. And these indels are basically, they often will shut a gene down. They'll screw up its function. And that's what they found most of the time. Instead of being able to make that CCR variant, CCR5 variant very precisely, they got indels instead. So they got little random insertions and deletions that basically screwed up the CCR5 gene. And so,
and frame shift mutation, and we're getting completely different proteins.
You get a stop codon. And so so that, I think, is really both that paper and the previous one that was trying to address beta thalassemia, I think, are really cautionary tales about what is going, the kinds of things that can go wrong and how challenging this is going to be. So a lot of the time, it's not going to work that well. Some people say, you know, CRISPR is evolving as a technology so fast that we'll get through these technological hurdles. And maybe we will, but I'm not so sure that's something that's going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, I did laugh because you had a section here with George Church, who is, you know, just a fantastic geneticist, a lot of, you know, very involved with genome sequencing. And I thought it was interesting because I did read his book, Regenesis, a few years back, but I giggled at your comment at some point, didn't hear that, like, that even that book, only 3 years old, has no mention of CRISPR.
Yeah.
That's how quickly this has come up. Yes.
Right.
You know?
It's amazing because now CRISPR is one of the few, you know, it's George's favorite thing, and he and I often, we don't totally see eye to eye on the use of CRISPR in humans, but it's been really fun because we've had this very collegial conversation by email about our different views on this, and he's really, I think he's much more optimistic, I think, than I am about how the technology is going to evolve and how useful it's going to be. Maybe I'm more of just a pessimist or skeptic by nature, but I think it's really fun to talk with him because he's doing, you know, while, for example, my lab is using CRISPR, his lab is actually making, like, new forms of CRISPR. They're, you know, one of the drivers evolving this technology, and so he's, you know, much more in tune with how there are improvements to this. You know, it's more efficient, it's more accurate, things like that. And so I definitely enjoy talking with him. But, you know, I can't wait to see. Maybe in a couple of years he'll have a new book that might be mostly on CRISPR, for all we know. And whereas Regenesis didn't mention it, really. So that's one of the things that I faced, the challenge in writing my book on this, is that things, even as I was writing it, then there would be a new headline, and I was like, oh, I have to go back and rewrite that, you know.
Yeah, I noticed that. I noticed that. I was like, I know how long it takes to write a book.
Yeah.
And I was like, I bet you're like every day going, oh, now I got to talk about the Chinese.
Yeah, new headline, go back to chapter 3 and work on that again, you know.
Right. But it is interesting. So you did mention here a list of 10 genes that George Church sort of has said are specific desirable traits, you know, and you include the MSTN and the CCR5 in there. But it was an interesting list to have stronger bones, bigger muscles, insensitivity to pain, which I think maybe is okay, you know, to be sensitive to pain.
Yeah, and I would add one of the other things that I thought was really interesting in reading up on George's writings and just communicating with him is he's very interested in this movement called transhumanism, which is something I also touch on in the book. And I think some of those desirable traits, I may not have realized this at first, but some of them, part of the reason I think that they were sort of, you know, highlighted is because they might be useful in particular for humans when they're out in space or like on, you know, during space flight or on a colony, because one of the things with transhumanism is there's this concern that we're going to screw up the Earth, and if we really want the human race to survive, we need to make a new, you know, sort of population of humans out there that, you know, perhaps, you know, in microgravity, tweaking how our bones develop or a muscle development or pain or radiation resistance. These are things that we might need to tweak if we're going to at some point decide we need to venture out into space in a more permanent kind of way.
So he can have a nice long chat he probably already has with Elon Musk.
Yeah, so there's a huge amount of interest in this, yeah. And so, you know, those of us who are sort of wild-type humans, you know, we may not fare so well in space, but you know, a genetically modified person, a GMO sapiens, or however we want to term it, They might do a lot better in space, and they might even evolve and become, somewhat of a different species. So that may seem like sci-fi, but I think, it's something that, it's talked about more seriously today than it might have been in the past.
And I think a lot that they learned from Scott Kelly's year in space, could start to change that list of desirable traits for outer space,
Right, it could, yeah.
Now, you have some ethical lines that you would like to draw in what we should do, let's say, at least right now, in human modification, and they differ from other people's. This is fine. And sure. You mentioned something about Feynman, just to get to the point of a very interesting ethical quandary, I thought, which is, if we're primarily worried about consequences of these genetic modifications that could be troublesome in one way or another, and if the only way we can find out what those consequences are is by doing the research that we don't think we should do because of the possible consequences that could be serious, what do we do about that? Is there a way to get to the other side of that line in acceptable or ethical steps, do you think? How do we get past that? Or do we just wait for that creep someplace else who doesn't care about ethics, who goes ahead and does it, and we learn from it, and then say, he was a Nazi dentist, but at least we've got the information?
It's something that I haven't really found a good solution to, because until we start making CRISPR to people, if we want to use that terminology, mm-hmm. we won't really know, how well it works, what might go wrong. So I think for the time being, we're left with, imperfect potential solutions. Some of those are just sort of anticipating, as you said, that some other people may go ahead and try this, and as much as we might condemn that, there might still be something, data-wise that comes out of it that is useful. I have mixed feelings about that. There's certainly not a lot that we can do to prevent someone from trying this, and even though I, for example, support a moratorium on using this in humans for the time being, that's not anything binding. Even if a whole country has a moratorium, people may not respect that. The other thing that we can do is, we can study CRISPR-Cas9 using stem cells, for example. There's a new technology called organoids that's really exciting, where we can make entire human organs, little mini versions in a dish from pluripotent stem cells. For example, little mini brains, little mini livers, kidneys. We can study CRISPR in that context. We can see how accurate it is, the outcomes on the organs, functions, things like that. The other thing that the two Chinese groups did was to specifically use non-viable human embryos. And so these are embryos, I think in both of these papers, last year's and this year's, that were fertilized by two sperm. And so there's an egg, two sperm fertilize it, and generally it's thought those embryos could never really develop into a human being. They can develop for a few days, like to the blastocyst stage. Mm-hmm. And so these groups have chosen that approach, that kind of model system, which they feel is more ethically acceptable. And so you can, for example, study the first 5 days of human development in that context with an embryo that can never become a human being. And there, I think, they feel there's more safeguards. It's not as ethically complicated. Others feel differently. They're still mm-hmm. opposed to that.
So more understanding, just working from where we are today, mm-hmm. might bring us things. But it also seems likely, it strikes me as you're talking, that we can't count on it, but it seems likely in very short order we may have new routes to this type of understanding that we don't even see on the horizon at the moment, given the pace and the unusual innovation that's happened, and that there may still be a way to get to the other side of that line in what more people could agree is an ethical fashion. But we can't really say, this is going to happen, because predictions are notoriously wrong when you're trying to guess.
And the other possibility, and this is something I touched on in the book, is that parents or parents-to-be may choose to go ahead and try to have a genetically modified child for whatever reason. They may have their own motivations. They may want to have a child that's related to them, but some very serious genetic disease runs in their family. And so they may feel, it's their parental choice. They may be able to find a fertility clinic, a researcher, to kind of form a team together, perhaps a surrogate mother that wants to go for this. And, I definitely would be very worried about that, but I'm not sure I or anyone else could really necessarily tell them not to proceed with that. And so But you're right, there also are likely to be technological innovations like these organoids. There may be other things like that that come up in the next few years that kind of blow our minds, you know, and allow us to really learn a lot about, you know, the potential use of CRISPR in human beings in ways that we can't even imagine now. The other point I'd like to make is that there's a lot of interest in using CRISPR in humans for gene therapy, which is a very different thing. And so in that case, for example, you could genetically modify just the blood cells, you know, the bone marrow cells of a person who has a blood disorder, and then give them back to that person and potentially cure them of a disease like SCID or something else. And so I think there's a lot more comfort with that kind of, you know, use of gene editing. And what I'm more concerned about in the book is the more what we call germline editing, where you actually reproduce, you know, a new human being that has a different gene. Yeah.
And it's still in these early days, we can still learn a lot from virtually anything that gets done with this CRISPR to see, right? Now, back to bring us back a little bit to the Gattaca zone, there are all sorts of arguments on one side or the other that I don't find terribly persuasive about why or why not or anything. And I thought, in a way, one of the better reasons that you gave sort of secondhand was when you were talking in your Gattaca and cultural chapter, and I'll quote now, you said, "Culturally, we are almost certainly unprepared." And I think that may be a very telling reason at the moment right now, that culturally we're unprepared for the idea of a designer baby. So now we can talk about being culturally prepared and when that's going to happen too.
Yeah, I think that's a big deal. And a lot of people I've talked to who are more on the sort of pro side, let's proceed with this, they really feel like today we're very different than we used to be as a species, because sometimes I'll bring up with them, you know, past examples of where we've really gone wrong culturally. And one example is with eugenics. And a lot of people, when they hear eugenics, they think Nazi Germany, but I like to redirect them to what happened. Indeed, first was in the U.S., where we actually legally, because there were laws on this, forcibly sterilized thousands of people here in the U.S. because they didn't fit our collective sense of what was, you know, better or even okay. They were thought of as lesser human beings. And so when I bring that up, people who are sort of, you know, on the opposite side from my view will often say, well, we couldn't, you know, we just wouldn't do that as a species because we're different. And I tell them, I'm not so sure. You know, I'm not so convinced that we're better than we were, say, 80 years ago, 50 years ago. And we're still human beings. We may have changed a little bit in that time. But oftentimes when, you know, you get a technology that's really powerful, and there are certain temptations, right? There's this idea, you know, like, I'm a parent, and as a parent, you want your kids to do well and be happy. And if you could bring in this technology and somehow you get the sense, you know, this is going to allow for your children to have a better life somehow, you know, it's going to be hard for many of us to resist that temptation. But there are consequences to that, right? And that's something I did a TED Talk last year in Vienna on designer babies. And I really, I tried to make it really personal in the sense that a certain family decided not to have a designer baby, but their neighbors did decide to have a designer baby. And that tension, you know, and the cultural impact, I really do think we're not necessarily ready as a species for the power that CRISPR could bring to bear if it is used in the embryo.
I think I'm cynical enough for that to lead me to agree with you on this one, that eugenics things and the we're just not like that, we can do better. I think these sorts of things are almost always prone to debasement by, you know, human efforts and things, and it's just not going to work. But you also mentioned a key difficulty in the whole thing is, oh, everyone might agree that it would be a great thing if we could make better babies, but what in the world is better that we can all agree on?
Right.
And that's a lot harder, isn't it?
That's a great question, and I was, you know, fascinated to find, you know, digging into historical records here in the U.S., these better baby contests that we held 80, 90 years ago, and then those evolved into fitter family contests, and I think it's so ironic that these things were, the context that they were in were state fairs, you know, where you also have the biggest tomato or, you know, the best pig, And they had score sheets. They literally had, and I include one of those in my book, where you could check off or give points to babies based upon how good they are, you know, good in quotation marks, you know. And, you know, if you look at the criteria, they're very, you know, they're things that are very debatable, you know. And as they evolved into these fitter family contests, they even went into, like, the parentage and, you know, they sort of brought in more of this heritability and so the idea of, you know, that kind of thing turbocharged by CRISPR is, it can be pretty terrifying, you know.
Well, that was an excellent example, too, because that seems a sort of obvious case of this debasement that can happen, even when people's motivations are naive and not evil. They were probably trying to do better, make it more fun, make it more interesting, and you end up step by step at this utter horror.
It was true, and a lot of times it's not, like you were saying, it's not that people are necessarily evil or there's some mad scientist who wants to use CRISPR for some bad thing. You know, it may be even fueled by good intentions, and it just, when you've got something so powerful, we know from other technologies like, you know, physics, you know, that the technology, you can end up with different uses, like there's this whole dual use, you know, issue that can come up, and I think that's certainly going to be the case with CRISPR, and a lot of it is not going to be some bad guy. It's going to be someone with good intentions, but, you know, it's going to go down a road that leads us into trouble, I think, potentially some of the time.
But near the end of the book, you're discussing things, and I thought it was a little dangerous for you to say, well, there is no rush to do clinical gene editing in humans. And I'm thinking, isn't the rush something that the people who want to be first perceive? There is a rush to be the first one, and that's a pretty big temptation, isn't it?
It is. I think it is a temptation because in science and also just culturally, there's certain benefits and rewards to being the discoverer, the first, you know. And I think at the same time, there's certain risks as well. And we saw that last year with that first paper, I think, that was CRISPRing human embryos.
Yes.
You know, I don't know that lab's motivations, but one possible one is that they wanted to be first. But they also, they got slammed. You know, they really got criticized. People said, you know, they didn't do the CRISPR using the latest versions of CRISPR, and they, you know, there were a lot of problems. And so it's interesting. I don't see them really getting a lot of benefit from having been first. And so at the same time, I think there is, you know, there really is a race mentality sometimes in science. And certainly things like Nobel Prizes will often go to the first, right? Mm-hmm. And they won't go to the person who came second, even if their research was better, you know, more thorough. And so
history books never mention someone's name and saying well known for being the fifth person to do something.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I think there are going to be different pressures that could push forward the use of CRISPR in human beings perhaps earlier than it should be. And one of them could be, you know, scientific motivations. The other thing that I was really naive about going into the book is the financial side of this. And that's something I've really learned a lot more about. And that's another thing that could really push this forward, and that is the idea that there could be a lot of monetary gain to be had from using CRISPR in human beings, whether it's, you know, the gene therapy kind of thing or germline, and people kind of poo-poo that, and they say, you know, that's not really something that scientists think about, but what really hit home for me countering that is we have the whole CRISPR patent battle going on. I don't know where you guys are. That, you know, this is partially about who's first, but it's also about who controls the intellectual property rights to CRISPR-Cas9.
Right.
And there are different companies out there, and they've gotten hundreds of millions of dollars, and some have said even now it's crossed the billion threshold, all related to CRISPR biotech, you know, endeavors of different companies. And I really think this could be, you know, a multi-billion dollar industry. So who gets those patent rights? Who's first? You know, all of those things could be important, and who tries certain things in the human context may also ultimately, you know, decide who gets future patents. And so there's a lot of different motivations besides just purely, you know, let's make, you know, something good happen through medicine, or let's advance knowledge. You know, those are great things, and I hope most of the focus is on that, but there are other things. We're all human beings that come into play, like, you know, who's going to be the first scientist, who gets the Nobel Prize, who has the patents, you know. It's complicated.
Yeah, oh, it's definitely complicated. As a biologist, this is a great time to be a biologist. I mean, just even in the past couple decades, PCR, GFP, CRISPR, each one becomes, you know, even more better than sliced bread. I mean, it just totally changes the way we do our work.
It does. And it's a fabulous time to be a biologist. Like, I couldn't be happier.
Yeah, I love it. And I love, you know, people will, like, watch my eyes light up when I talk about, like, CRISPR or GFP. You know, over the years, it's been something different every time. And people are like,
yeah,
I'm really excited about this. I said, but you have no idea. When you did things the old way, you know, it's... You know, and you go to this more efficient way or something that gives you a little trick to be able to see something better. I said it just changes everything.
That's a great point. And I would say, you know, even in my own lab, when someone comes to me or they present at our lab meeting and they're successful in having CRISPRed a gene, there's sort of a thrill for all of us. We're really excited, you know. Like, this actually worked, and it took, you know, a few months, not a few years, and now we can do all these really exciting studies on stem cells or cancer. And so there's a really thrilling aspect to science. And, you know, as much as in the book there's a lot of cautionary stuff, you know, I would also say I'm really genuinely excited about CRISPR. I think probably most of what's going to come out of it is positive.
Right.
And, you know, the vast majority of labs have no interest in designer babies or anything like that, but I felt like there was sort of a hole, you know, a gap in the discussion because people were, you know, understandably, they don't necessarily want to talk about the complicated stuff, you know, the eugenics stuff, the designer baby stuff, and I really felt like someone needed to spark more of that discussion. So that was part of what was in my mind a couple of years ago as I was thinking about writing this book and starting to write it is, you know, as much as I really feel positively about CRISPR and genetic modification, we need a really in-depth, you know, frank discussion of all the aspects of it.
Right, I agree. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, even if someone's very positive about something, I think in science, and when it comes to ethics, it's important to have the conversations.
It is, for sure.
That someone brings up, this could be a problem, this might be, you know, whatever. Let's talk about this, I see we're getting towards the end, but this gene drive chain reaction, like, you bring up GMO mosquitoes. So if we make some permanent change that really just gets in the gene pool of a species, whether it's humans or something else, we could see a chain effect that we don't know what the consequences will be.
That's true.
So it's not just one mutated human or one mutated mosquito or one mutated C. elegans. We're seeing, you know, maybe a whole subspecies come out or something.
Well, onto germline modification then.
Sorry?
This is the back to germline modification now.
Yeah,
right?
So with gene drive, I think gene drive is one of the most exciting but scary sort of applications of CRISPR-Cas9 because it has this potential for a chain reaction kind of effect that I think would be much less sort of amenable to us sort of reining it in should something go wrong. And so the basic idea of gene drive is you make an organism, whether it's a mosquito or a person, it wouldn't work as well in people, I don't think. That basically when they transmit a genetic modification, they also transmit the machinery to make that genetic modification again in the other chromosome. And so you end up basically with a self-propagating genetic modification. It's sort of not really a virus, but it could almost be thought of as contagious because when you make a gene-drive organism like a mosquito, you know, over time, the entire population will get that gene drive change. Mm-hmm. And so people have talked about actually releasing these gene drive organisms, for example, to tackle malaria, which is a really serious concern, or something like Zika, because you could basically change an entire population of disease-carrying mosquitoes in such a way that they can't transmit the disease very well anymore. But the risk there is, again, that this is not sort of a one-time, one-off kind of experiment that would naturally end. It's actually a genetic change that would be self-propagating. It might be something that you can't really stop. And if those mosquitoes hop on a plane, go somewhere else, you know, or, you know, if we're talking about other organisms, you know, it really could be something. I've also called it on my blog a gene spill because it really could be like a spill in the sense that you can't really control it. And so I think Gene Drive is something that is going to get a lot more attention. Even, you know, in unexpected ways, like the guy Clapper, who's like the head of national intelligence for the U.S., I can't remember his first name, James Clapper or something like that, he actually mentioned CRISPR as a potential WMD like a month ago.
Yeah,
I think he was referring to Gene Drive because you could, you know, a terrorist could make a weapon that would really be pretty nasty, that would be very difficult to control. And that's something, I guess, you know, even the people at NSA, CIA, stuff like that, they're actually seriously thinking about these kinds of things as things they need to anticipate. But
well, they've got the thing for it. This was the idea of Roundup Ready humans. Right?
Right, exactly, yeah. And so I think what most scientists are more concerned about is more of an accidental situation where someone has made, for example, a fruit fly that has Gene Drive, and that, and some of those flies fly out, you know, the door, and they mate with naturally occurring fruit flies out in the neighborhood, and now you've got, you know, a Gene Drive fruit fly population, whether it's in LA or wherever, and, you know, you may not even know it, and all of a sudden, you know, most of the naturally occurring fruit flies in Los Angeles or Bangkok or wherever, they have this Gene Drive and we don't even know, and they're spreading it to their offspring. And so we could end up with genetically modifying, you know, a bunch of organisms, and it just was an accident and we don't really know the outcomes.
Right. And actually, this is making me think about in the 70s and 80s, when Russia was working so hard to create terrifying bioweapons.
Right.
Tularemia, things that you could be infected, but then maybe 3 years later, boom, you're sick. And now, could you imagine if back then CRISPR was available?
Yeah, it's really scary.
We are nearing the end, but I really wanted to talk about, because you're an expert at this, I really wanted to talk about your outreach concerning this. I mean, it's what motivated you to write this book, what motivates you to keep a blog. Right. And, why it is so important to you that you communicate these things to the general public. Like, yeah, what drives you to do these things?
I think I've always sort of had a side to me that wanted to communicate, like I was the editor of my high school and college newspaper. And so I think that's just part of who I am. But also I think my own experience with cancer about 6.5 years ago really changed how I view things. It got me from just being a cancer researcher to being a cancer patient. And so it made me feel like, I think I had some, you know, concerns about being very outspoken prior to that, because you never know if you upset someone who's very powerful in science, or some people even think, you know, scientists shouldn't blog or anything, they should just keep their heads down and focus on the science. But I really felt like after tackling cancer, you know, I felt much more emboldened to just be more outspoken. And the other thing is, you know, I've really been focused on stem cells most of my career here at UC Davis, and I saw a lot of people being manipulated to get stem cell therapies or treatments that weren't really, you know, rigorously science-based. Mm-hmm. And some of these patients even contacted me and said, you know, what should I do? Should I get this treatment? And so that's really, I think, part of where sort of the activist side of me really got engaged, because I felt like people were being taken advantage of. And I feel sort of a sense of, like, wanting the stem cell field to be doing good stuff. And so that, I think that was really the first thing that got me going. And I wrote the first book on stem cells. You know, my first book was on stem cells. I blogged mostly about stem cells up until recently. And so I just feel like, you know, there's a lot of benefit to be had from scientists engaging with the public, talking with patients. It's often very hard to do. It's complicated. Patients will throw really good, difficult questions at you, but I think there's a lot of benefit that can come from it.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I'm glad there are people like you out there talking, because you could be swindled with the stem cell thing and stem cell tourism and things like that. So I think you were uniquely positioned then to talk about the GMO sapiens using CRISPR, right?
Yeah, and as much as I was excited about using CRISPR in my own lab, it became pretty clear to me that, again, you could use it in human embryos, you know, just the way you use it in cells and culture, and some people might go the wrong way with that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right, and then, and there'll be promises, come to Bangkok, and we can assure that your baby will be faster, yeah, stronger.
And you'll also get hysterical contrary people and ridiculous laws being passed to protect us from this horrible Frankenstein effect.
Right, and that was something I wanted to stress in the book, is I'm not opposed to like GMO plants and foods. Mm-hmm. I it's not something I really worry about. I'm more concerned with the GMO human, you know, potential in the future, and so, and this thing where we may see like genetic tourism, you know, things like that.
So we all prefer a rationally informed public, and we know how easy that is.
Right, and so I definitely tried to avoid like fear mongering. I tried to present both sides. Mm-hmm. I quoted people, you know, in the book who really have very different perspectives. So I think that was hopefully valuable.
Yeah, I think you did a fantastic job. And for those of you who joined us late, this the book we're talking about is GMO Sapiens, The Life-Changing Science of Designer Babies by Paul Knopfler, PhD professor at UC Davis. Very interesting conversation today. Yeah, I thought this was fantastic. And it's funny, I kept thinking, Jeff, in my head of like, you know, we had Misha Angrist on, who was Personal Genome Project person number 4. Mm-hmm. Right, and David Epstein wrote the book on the sports gene, and then of course Paul mentioned Emily Anthes in our in his book, who wrote Frankenstein's Creatures
or Frankenstein's Cat.
Yes. So you know, so I feel like this topic really embraces so many things we've already touched on before. Mm-hmm. I'm excited because I'm listening to this going, excellent, this hangout is going in my genomics class this summer for the section where we talk about CRISPR, because I said, I better get CRISPR in before somebody wins the Nobel Prize. Yeah. And people will go, what was that? I'll be like, if you were in my class, you know what CRISPR is. So, Paul, thank you so much. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we sign off?
The only thing would be I hope people really talk more about CRISPR and get excited about it, but also aren't afraid of the complicated sides to it, like the eugenic stuff. And, you know, and I've really been encouraged to see people like Jennifer Doudna, you know, who's, you know, a leader on CRISPR. She's really talked a lot about the complexities to it and also her worries about eugenics. And she was really the one last year who got the scientific community talking about this. So I just hope people think and talk and do their homework on it, and it's a very exciting time, like we mentioned earlier, and I hope people will talk more and more about this, because I think it could really change us as a species, and that sounds, you know, like an overstatement, but it really could. Mm-hmm.
Actually, so this will be my encouragement, if you're interested in this, pick up his book, GMO Sapiens, and actually, I know the FDA eventually will have that hearing on stem cells in cosmetics, etc., and you will be covering it the best you can on your blog, and so, and you can find him on Twitter as at P. Knopfler, Knopfler. It will be under the video. We'll make sure you can find it. So be sure to follow him if you want to keep up with these things. So,
great.
Okay, everybody, Jeff, as always, thank you. Paul, a big thanks to you for an informative and enlightening discussion. Very articulate, very passionate. I loved it. So thank you all for tuning in, and we'll see you again soon. Right. Bye.
Bye.